Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash, as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to The Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
Straight up brought to you by liquor. Maybe I should say liqueur.
Liqueur. I think we realized that wine just would not cut it when we're going to be talking about the Joker. Needed something a little stiffer. And I believe that this limoncello will do the trick.
I liked your tie-in. I didn't know how to tie it in. You said it's actually kind of the color of his hair. And it is. It is very greenish.
Greenish, yellowish, Joker-ish.
We are going to bat lead off tonight with the Joker, or just Joker, pardon me. And this is a film that we don't really need to talk about plot. You get it. It's an origin story of a guy who became an infamous Batman villain. What I want to talk about, what I want to focus on, is how Joker is impacting our culture. And it is, through many, many, many facets. It is impacting our culture. First off, I noticed, when we arrived at the press screening, enhanced security. Like the old, like they usually kind of fake wand you. Oh, you know, don't record the movie. They were straight up wanding.
Yeah, back turn. They had me turn around, do the front, the back.
Their Warner Brothers is not worried, but they went so far as to issue a statement saying, "No, the movie does not condone violence. Does not endorse violence. It does not incite violence." That is because they remember 2012, the midnight screening of The Dark Knight Rises, which did not even star the Joker. There was a mass shooting, and a guy connected himself with the film, and that has now morphed into a sort of lore. And all across America this weekend, security is heightened in movie theaters.
Well, the mass shooter himself in Aurora likened himself to the Joker.
People wonder how serious he was.
It doesn't matter. That's the whole point, is it just doesn't matter. And so, sure, Warner Brothers will come out and say, this film does not condone violence, or we do not condone violence. Of course it doesn't. It's a movie. Of course they don't. There's no, purposeful, there's no intent. The question remains, though, that there is a thread throughout this film that's very disturbing and distressing, and the concern that's very valid is that there are going to be potentially loners, you know, bullied people, folks with, you know, people with mental illness who could view this film and see themselves in the Joker to some degree. And that's where the concern comes in. You know, this isn't like Pennywise the Clown in It, where there's that supernatural element to Pennywise. This Joker is the every person. He's too familiar. He lives in our society, and that's what's so frightening.
Well, society ignores him, which spurs him to do certain things. What I wanted to... Why Joker? Why not when John Wick 3 came out, where people not like, but it incites violence. It glorifies
but see,
violence.
I had this discussion with somebody just earlier today about John Wick 3 and how I like the John Wick films, even though they are so
insanely violent.
They are way more violent. However, there is a absolute hero within John Wick that you can root for. And that, to me, that's the biggest difference, is that John Wick is only killing the bad guys. He's very careful about not killing innocents. And you know that it's so over the top that you can forgive what it's doing. Whereas with this, sometimes it's too real. And that's where the problem is the realism and the fact that it's all too familiar and too plausible. John Wick is totally implausible. Joker type violence is not only plausible, but we see it way too often.
I have two immediate responses to that. The first one is Arthur Fleck, who Joaquin Phoenix plays, Arthur Fleck, is he an anti-hero where you're actually rooting for the bad guy, which is kind of the definition. You're rooting for the guy who's not the hero, the anti-hero. And B, two, does he kill anyone who's actually innocent?
I feel that he inspired a movement within the film where people then felt that they were emboldened and somehow given carte blanche to then riot. And I do think that some innocent people get caught up in that crossfire.
But Arthur does not necessarily kill an innocent.
But he relishes the violence and what he's incited. He you see him, you know, he absolutely is thrilled with what he has emboldened other people to do.
I want to read you this great headline I read in The Onion today. FBI warns, Downton Abbey screenings could be target for shootings by disgruntled royalists. The individuals in question are in a state of constant anger and dissatisfaction, frustrated to be living in a world that does not honor the crown.
I do find it extremely ironic, funny, that Downton Abbey, in which nothing happens, and was PG, did very well at the box office because people were embracing the fact that it is so comforting and nonviolent. And then a week later, you're going to have this film Joker that's going to make a gazillion dollars and is everything that the people who streamed to go see Downton Abbey are absolutely do not want to see in Joker, or we're happy to not have to have an alternate viewing experience to something like Joker. And so to have those in back-to-back debuts is pretty funny to me.
Well, to wrap up this part of the review, because we're going to keep going. I have seen 9 more movies this year more violent than Joker. And it's kind of sticking in my craw, it's kind of grinding my gears that Joker is the one that is the lightning rod.
I'm telling you, it's the lightning rod because it's to everybody knows this guy, this disenfranchised, bullied Arthur Fleck character. And that's the difference. I mean, this film, it's very important to point out that it is not meant for kids. It's a very tangential connection to the Batman franchise. There is a Wayne character in this film, but it is not in any way a standard DC Comics kind of film. And so kids cannot and should not be seeing this. It is a gritty drama inspired by 1970s fare like Taxi Driver and King of Comedy and I think One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. You know, there's hints of all of that. But each of those films had their own narrative within the film. This is leveraging Batman. This is leveraging the DC Comics universe to make a gazillion dollars. And that's the difference, I think, from these other films that have violence in them but are contained in their own storylines. This one is just basically saying, here's the guy who grew up and grew into Batman's greatest villain, but this isn't a Batman movie. And so you're like, well, it's really just a movie about a mentally ill guy who has a psychotic break and turns violent. And so that's really what this film is ultimately about. And I don't think any of these other movies that have a lot of violence in them take that same kind of approach. And so it's just it's a darker, more complicated, more disturbing kind of violence.
I agree and emphasize, it is not a Batman movie. Batman movies, all the way up to the Christian Bale trilogy, were campy. They actually kind of made fun of themselves. It's actually not even, I found it not even to be a movie about the Joker. It's a movie about a mentally ill, sad clown.
Right.
I'll just put my stamp on this part. Anyone who says the Joker glorifies or incites violence has not seen it.
I disagree.
I empathized, and this is where I'll come out and say, I relished the film far more than you did. I really like this film. In fact, when the credits were rolling, I was somewhere between like and really like. 3 to 4 days later, it keeps actually growing on me. It's getting stronger, and none of it was inciting. I felt so... I have nothing in common with Arthur Fleck. Nothing. But here I
Thank
am...
Thank goodness for that.
...in my movie seat, identifying with him, sympathizing for him. It's like, you know what? The world has not treated you fairly, sir. You were dealt a lousy hand. You're actually probably doing the best you can. And you know what, Gotham City? You created your own monster. Gotham City created the Joker.
I agree with all of that. The problem is that we are left to sympathize with a serial killer. And so there is a problem with that.
You don't think people enjoyed Hannibal Lecter?
I think it's just a different kind of empathy and sympathy that we feel towards Arthur Fleck. And that's going to be a very interesting thing. I don't think all the security for opening night, I don't think that matters at all. I think that it's going to take days, weeks, months, possibly years before some people that might feel some strong affinity for Joker and what he accomplishes and his madness. And that's my fear, is for what it could wreak down the line, not in the immediate future.
I worry what movies like Top Gun have wreaked down the line. You know how many people join the Navy after that thing?
As I was saying, while you were just absolutely enthralled at the end and sat through those end credits like nobody's business, folks like me were just running for the nearest rom-com.
You got a point, because this Joker is an example of a critic audience divide, actually. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has a tomato critic rating of 69%. A fresh tomato indeed, but not high. Mm-hmm. It has an audience rating of 93. And that could be because fanboys are inflating it. It's already in the top 10 on IMDb of all time. Yes, fanboys might be inflating. However, I believe audiences do like this more than specifically American critics. Because I think, I could be wrong, my opinion, American critics are responding to the cultural backlash.
I don't think so. I found justification in the cultural backlash.
European critics love this film.
I'm not, that's my biggest problem, is that I didn't not like this film. I didn't like this film. I can't say whether or not others should go and see it. It's divisive for a reason. I think there's so much to unpack in this film, which for you is a good thing.
Isn't that great?
And for me is, oh, my head hurts. And so depending on where you fall and the kind of movie that you really want to see, that's where you're going to come out of this. If you go into this expecting in any way, there are no heroes, there are no villains, there's no joy in this film at all.
Oh.
And so if you
The joy
go
is in
the
filmmaking.
The joy for you is in the psychoses of these people. And I just am wary of sending anyone into the darkness. And so maybe psychology students would probably get a lot out of seeing this film. And then folks who like the Heath Ledger, the darker Batman type turn.
This is darker than that.
It's darker. And so if you've got your spectrum of Jokers, this is on the darkest of the dark side and goes beyond.
Well, I want to find out, in your opinion, exactly where does Joaquin Phoenix's Joker rack and stack in the pantheon? We know Jack Nicholson's overdone cartoon version. Just a cartoon. Heath Ledger is more of a sociologist / ability to kill people with pencils. So, just like really good. And Phoenix, he's not power. Arthur Fleck couldn't kill anybody with a pencil. He's a sad sack who gains a platform from the tabloid industry, who sort of creates him. The tabloid industry. There's some murders that happen in the film, which the tabloids latch onto and bubble up. Looking how Gotham City looks, how Todd Phillips makes it look, three murders happen there every hour, let alone, these particular three on this particular day. He's created. So, yeah, there I am repeating myself that they created their own monster. But in your opinion, who is Hannah's favorite Joker of all time? Who do you identify with? Who do you enjoy watching?
Other than you? the other Joker that I prefer would be Cesar Romero's Joker of the 1960s Batman TV series, which was a totally campy production of Joker. And I'm, you know, that to me was what I was always in my head. That's who the Joker was. That's who Batman's nemesis was. It's that particular performance from the Adam West very campy version of Batman. However, when I look at Jack Nicholson, Heath Ledger, and Joaquin Phoenix, I don't think any of them, there's no ranking to be done, because each one was in a different movie by a very different director. And each of those performances was good in what it was intended to be, and with the...
Not ranking on who did it best, but who you really... If you think of the Joker, who are you thinking of?
I do. My brain flashes back to Cesar Romero. It just does. That's the picture of the Joker that I always had in my head. And beyond that, it's equal. I would almost say that for me... then it's a hodgepodge. It's a little bit of Jack Nicholson and a bit of Heath Ledger. This one, to me, just, again, it doesn't feel like the Joker character from Batman. It feels like its own dark story about a disenfranchised, mentally ill young man.
Agree. It's not the Joker. Personally, I think you're right about, you identify with the Joker from your childhood. I'm a Jack Nicholson Joker guy, because that came out, Tim Burton's version came out, I think, when I was 9, and I thought, wow, he was campy to everybody else, but to a 9-year-old, he's actually borderline scary, like, mm-hmm. Ooh, this Joker guy, and I think everyone who lost their minds in the Heath Ledger era was younger than me. It was their first Joker. They were too young for Jack Nicholson, and they found this really off the beaten path, never done before version of the Joker, which he did. Speaking of, you mentioned the director in the film the director made. This is directed by Todd Phillips. We know him from the Hangover trilogy. He had Zach Galifianakis in the Wolf Pack and people getting lost for 24 hours. And he also did horrible comedies like School for Scoundrels and things like that. And here he is jumping ship off the comedy track, off the screwball slapstick track, and he gave an interview that went viral. He said, "Of course I got out of comedy and switched to drama. You can no longer make comedy in this woke culture. Nothing's funny anymore. Any and all comedy will offend somebody, and 50 million people on Twitter will tear you apart for it." So he said, "I had to leave and go over to drama." Naturally, 50 million people on Twitter tore him a new one.
That's a cop-out. It's a total cop-out. And I think if, you know, big studios gave half the kind of marketing and push to a film like Booksmart or Good Boys. Good Boys was a great comedy that very few people saw.
And it was just as offensive to offend everyone equally.
Exactly. And so to say that, well, you know, you can't make a good comedy, that there are some that have been made, but movies like Joker just get all the buzz, all the press, all the marketing. And I think that's a shame, because people are missing out on some funny movies. But also I think that times have changed. And so between the way that social media is and the fact that you have more and more options on so many different streaming services, people are getting their entertainment in so many different ways. And I think a lot of people are getting their comedy fix from Hulu and Netflix and just finding old comedy stuff that they hadn't seen before. So I would say that it's just a symptom of a changing society, and that Todd Phillips using that as an excuse, I find very weak. And he did that War Dogs movie, which was okay, and was sort of attempting, I think, in some ways to bridge a little bit of drama and comedy and what's happening out in the real world.
War Dogs was pretty good. We took last week off, so there's one film we saw, a documentary we did not get to discuss, we're just going to briefly catch you up with now, and it's called Where's My Roy Cohn? And that's an actual quote from the President of the United States last year saying, where is my Roy Cohn? Because Roy Cohn was actually his personal lawyer back in the 80s doing horrible things. Roy Cohn being just this euphemism, this turn of phrase of, I need an attack dog to go out and legally kill people. It's directed by Matt Tiernauer, who we've talked about a number of times on this podcast from Citizen Jane and Studio 54. I found Roy Cohn to be very similar to those. He's always got a lot of pictures, a lot of videos. You'll learn who Roy Cohn was, his impact on our society, which continues to this day. It did not knock my socks off. It's just another documentary to continue our national nightmare.
It is. I mean, when you talk about modern day villains, the Joker, you know, there's nothing compared to the real guy we had in Roy Cohn. And really from the 1950s on, from the McCarthy era. And I mean, just the amount of stuff that he was mixed up in with his strategy of basically just being attack, never apologize, and never admit you're wrong. And that's why Trump idolizes him. And I thought this documentary was fine, but I have a hard time giving this guy any more time in the spotlight, even posthumously.
Fair enough. Fair enough. That's a perfect way to end that discussion. Since we took last week off, Hannah and I went our separate ways, and we could watch whatever we wanted, whatever we wanted. And oddly enough, it blows my mind that I chose two Charlie movies, as she would say, and she chose like 3.5 Hannah films.
No, mine are Charlie movies too. I ended up with 3 Charlie movies, and you had 2 Charlie movies. I just picked what looked to me like the least offensive of the Charlie options.
I like maybe that's true, actually, but I don't think that's how it's going to turn out. This is going to be brief. We're going to do like a minute or less per film. I will begin. I saw a film called Ms. Purple, and it was at Sundance. It was nominated for the Grand Jury Prize, and it's from a man named Justin Chan. I do not remember him in the Twilight franchise, but he was a character in the Twilight series named Eric. If there was an Asian guy in that series, he was the Asian guy.
All right.
So let me read you the log line here. A young woman who works as a karaoke hostess in Koreatown, which is in L.A., reconnects with her estranged brother in the final days of their father's life. The young woman is played by Tiffany Chu, and I will go ahead and say this is a breakout performance by her. Mm-hmm. I really, really enjoyed her. This is for, you wanted me to say who this movie's for, Asian American cinema. I don't know if that's a subgenre, but it's for Asian Americans, because it's all about their culture in that one certain section of Los Angeles. It is super serious, super dark, extremely depressive. I like depressing films, and I wanted to die.
That's so funny because Artie Chick reviewed it, so people can read her review at chickflix.net, but she called it this indie gem, and she thought it was very stylish with very good performances, and so she is not Asian, and so I do think that she felt it has much broader appeal than you do, so maybe the appeal will be more for broads versus Charlie's.
Don't get me wrong. I enjoyed the film. I liked the film, even though it's one of the most depressing things I've ever seen in my life.
More distressing than Joker?
But no, it's not. But it might appeal to people that are really into that hardcore family drama stuff. Mm-hmm. Like if you're into family dramas like This Is Us, but don't want to cry, but really just want to feel angst and god-awful feelings, maybe Ms. Purple's for you.
Great.
The second one I saw is Japanese. It's called First Love. In Japanese, it's called Hatsukoi. And it's from Takashi Miike. We've talked about him. In 2017, we talked about Blade of the Immortal, which was one of absolutely the most bloody films I've ever seen in my entire life.
I think I remember that.
Takashi Miike is so prolific. He makes about 4 movies a year. He's over 100 films now, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. He is known for genre mashups. This is film noir and that Yakuza gangster film and some satire. A young boxer and a call girl get caught up in a drug smuggling scheme over the course of one night in Tokyo. This is for fans of absurdism, Japanese crime films, samurai swords, sword violence. If you like Lucy Liu's character in Kill Bill Volume 1, Oren Ishii, this reminds me of that. I texted you immediately after I saw this, and I said, there's a moment in this film where a guy gets his head chopped off. he blinks at the camera and smiles.
And I was like, all right, I don't need to see that one. Thank you very much.
I enjoyed this film more than Miss Purple. I didn't love it. It's not going to make my foreign film list because I do have major problems with this film. It's only like a 2.5 out of 4, but you know, it'll get the job done if you're a samurai completist.
Okay.
No, I mean, it's one of those that could almost become a cult classic. It's just so absurd and so making fun of itself and its genre.
Well, it's very interesting. This is a time of year where we are just bombarded with films and smaller films. So while we're sitting here waiting, you have your big film like Joker that comes out. Each week you have like one or two really big ones. But then we are just getting just tons and tons of optional links for some of these smaller films. And I choose the ones that for some one reason or another just hold some interest to me from the synopsis. But this is a week where all those other films were what I would consider to be films that you should be seeing. But because you did not choose to see any of them.
I did what you did. I picked the ones I wanted to see.
But I do think all of these you would potentially, maybe not. I was going to say you would like. The first one I saw was called The Climbers. And this is a Chinese film directed by Daniel Lee, who you've probably seen his stuff. Three Kingdoms, 14 Blades, I don't know. It's I think he's out of Hong Kong. And this is some very strange hybrid of what I would consider an arty movie, a foreign film, a mainstream movie, and a Chinese propaganda film.
No, thank you.
And so it's based on a true story that I certainly was not aware of and that I'm sure China would like more people to be aware of. But basically, it's a Mount Everest climbing. It's a mountain climbing movie.
And that's
it tells the story. But I mean, there's visually, cinematically, there's some really cool stuff in there. But it tells about the first Chinese climbers to summit Mount Everest. And they actually did so from a very challenging particular north ridge of the mountain. And so it starts in 1960 with this group of climbers making it to the summit, these Chinese climbers. But, there's like an avalanche and all kinds of stuff happens. And the camera is sacrificed while somebody's trying to save somebody. They lose the camera in the interim. So here they make it to the summit, but there's no photo evidence. So even though they've actually buried some stuff on the summit to prove that they were there, they get back down, they get back to China, and it's like, well, where's the picture? You have to have this 360-degree photo to prove that you actually made it to the summit. And so then these poor mountaineers who had been through so much end up kind of getting disgraced, and it's like a shameful time. And so everybody kind of goes off to their separate corners, and it gets really kind of just sad that they're not revered as they should be for having accomplished this incredible feat. But then you fast forward 15 years and 1975, and China reconstitutes this mountaineering team and gives them the go-ahead to try again. And so it's about that second climb and all the physical challenges and sacrifices that are made. And it's very much like the Everest movie. So any American-made movie about mountain climbing, and it still is that same age-old question, why? Why would you do this? Why would you put yourself through this? Why climb that mountain? And the answer from all these films is because it's there. And so it's kind of a very interesting, inspiring film, but it gets very heavy-handed with the sort of the music and the propaganda, and it tries to insert every single cliche from every sports drama and romance, you know, romantic drama out there, and there's a romance thread that takes place throughout this film too. So it would be a fun watch, I think, for mountain climbers, and if you like Chinese cinema, then this might be one to check out.
Oh, thanks. Next.
So the next one is a very different kind of sports drama and also a foreign film that you were supposed to watch called Britt Marie Was Here, or Britt Marie Var Här in the Swedish. And so it is. It's this Swedish film that the story was, it's based on the book, a book written by the same guy who did A Man Called Ove, which is one of my favorite books. And they made it into a movie in 2016. And this is not nearly as powerful and as strong as Ove, but it's a heartwarming little film is what I would really describe it as. It's about this woman in her 60s. She spent decades just cleaning house and making dinner for her husband and very stuck in routine and has never, you know, never held a job. And then she discovers that her husband has been having an affair. And so she leaves him and she can't get any work. The only job that's available is to be like a youth counselor and coach to this group of kids in this remote town in the middle of nowhere. And so she takes the job. And it's one of those films where, of course, the kids learn something from her about responsibility and perseverance. And she ends up learning a lot from the kids as well. They teach her about, you know, chasing your dreams at any age. And so it's all very familiar. It doesn't break any new ground, but it's a very easy watch that bridges that mainstream and arty divide. And it's in Swedish with German and English subtitles.
Next.
And I saved the best for last because this is one that you should see. And everybody should see, but very few people will. But it is, you talk about how none of, you know, these films don't have real heroes. We're not really seeing real heroes and stuff these days. This is a true story about a true hero who also just happens to be a pretty interesting character. And it's called, it's a documentary called Jim Allison Breakthrough. And Jim Allison won the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 2018. And he discovered it, basically the immune system's role in defeating cancer and attacking cancer. And it led to all sorts of new immunotherapies. And this guy has probably saved, through his research and through his findings, potentially millions and millions of lives. And so, but he's not like your typical scientist. I mean, this is this long-haired Texan who, you know, likes to play the harmonica and drink beer with and play along with Willie Nelson. And somehow they got, what's his name? From who hosted Saturday Night Live last week? Woody Harrelson. Woody Harrelson does some narration throughout this documentary. And so, and it's directed, written, and produced by Bill Haney, who did The Last Mountain. I don't know if you ever saw that one. And The Price of Sugar. And it's just a very interesting way to tell this story about a true pioneer. I mean, this guy is not at all what you would expect from somebody who then ended up devoting, I mean, really just devoting so much of his personal and professional life to being in the lab. He had a lot of cancer in his family, and he lost his mother to lymphoma when he was 11, and he just made it his mission in life to try and cure cancer. And it's about, you learn so much about why drugs can take so long. When something's working and it can still take so long to get to the average person, years and years, and the role that big pharma plays in clinical trials and getting them started or stopped. And it just is, it should be seen, at anybody who's been impacted by cancer or who has had somebody's life saved by immunotherapy should be watching this film and then sending Jim Allison a giant thank you note. And it should be shown in classrooms from grade school through grad school.
You know, oddly enough, it reminds me of Molly Ivins. He says, you know, she did the same, but she was also a Texan who liked beer.
Yeah, and so Texas has characters, has big characters, but this is one where you actually really do learn. I have a much greater understanding of T cells and T cell blockers and how they attack a tumor than I ever would have otherwise. And at the same time, you're going, how did he become friends with Willie Nelson? And that's just the kind of film this is. It's sort of a very interesting glimpse into a a modern day hero who really deserves to get his due. And so I hope people seek this one out.
Very well. My favorite film by far this week is Joker. It will make a billion dollars. I hope they never make another one. I hope it's a one-off. I hope it's not a franchise. I don't want to see Joker 2. I don't want to see Bruce Wayne grow up and confront the Joker. It's really good as it is.
Jim Allison is the one that nobody will see, but everybody should. It's the hero of the bunch.
Fair enough. Next week, we'll try our best to get back to our regular scheduled programming. But actually, if you like this new format, let us know. Maybe we'll keep going to see very different films. On behalf of the Cinema Clash, I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.